Welcome to episode 26 of New Tech People. This marks 1 year's worth of content for New Tech People. Today we've got James Weekly. James is data architect at NIB. He's just returned from the US where he was speaking at a conference over there. Interesting to hear James's take on his rise into the data ranks. Hope you enjoy this episode. All right, welcome to episode 26 of New Tech People. Today we've got James Weekly, data architect at NIB. Welcome, James.
Thanks for having me.
Another NIB stalwart.
Yeah, how many have you had from NIB now?
A few.
We make up a good chunk of the local scene.
Yeah, it's probably in proportion to the Newcastle Tech
scene. It is.
There's a relatively big tech team over at NIB. And doing some pretty cool technology. I think... picked people from different parts of the tech team, some different stories. It's easier from that perspective rather than sort of double dipping in the same area, but at least, you know, everyone sort of comes with a different angle.
Yep.
Mate, data architect, how did you get to a job title like that?
Well, I'll start from the beginning if you like.
Hey, all right, let's wind it way back. How'd you get into tech?
I was into computers when I was in high school.
Yeah.
I actually grew up in Gunnedah, or near Gunnedah, out near Tamworth.
Yeah, I've been there. My mum's family grew up in Boggabri.
Okay.
And yeah. Gunnedah.
Generally, everyone knows someone from Gunnedah.
I've been out there many a times around Christmas time, which was too hot for my liking.
Yeah, fair enough. So that's where I grew up, being into IT. When I finished school, I kind of got a job at a local IT place, and it's kind of like a IT kind of business consulting / systems integrator for pretty small kind of rural businesses, a lot of agriculture businesses, doctor surgeries and little law firms and stuff. This was 2002, so pretty early days as far as, you know, it was before broadband or ADSL was even in town. So lots of running around in cars and doing kind of a bit of everything. So when your remit's very broad, so it could be anything from my printer's broken to doing a server refresh or even some application development. Back then it was kind of .NET was brand new, so there's a bit of that going on. Kind of whatever the customer needed.
Yeah, it's probably not a bad stomping ground, right?
To try and
wear multiple hats, get a bit of an insight into sort of everything.
Yeah, and being very small, there was only four of us there, so kind of thrown in the deep end as far as within a couple of weeks, you know, you get given a car and you've got to go out and see a customer.
Mm-hmm.
As a 19-year-old, you kind of have to very quickly get comfortable talking with, you know, business owners and so on. But where I sort of got into that role was I was into Linux at high school, and the business owner wanted to make a bet on Linux and use it in a business environment. So he kind of got me into, rather than just install Windows everywhere, we're doing some Linux stuff as well, and did that for a couple of years. It was while I was doing that, I also joined the Army Reserve in Tamworth.
Yeah, right.
It was a bit of a weird story going to that. I think it was a few of my mates at the time. I got home from work and they said, "Hey, we're going to go and join the reserves. Do you want to come?" I said, "Yeah, sure." And, it was
just a small off the. Off
yeah,
the
well, bat. It was a bit. It was a bit kind of in the moment, but I also figured it would be a job that I could take with me. I knew I was going to move at some point to study and work elsewhere, so I figured that'd be a good job that I could have waiting for me if I moved to, I don't know, Sydney or Armidale or Newcastle. Yep. And, although most of the guys that were going to join didn't end up getting through the recruitment process for various reasons, so I think it was just me and one of my mates who ended up in there driving APCs, personnel carriers, for a couple of years. And then I decided to move. Well, I applied for a few different university positions, got one at Newcastle.
Mm-hmm.
Hadn't really been here before that, so moved here when I was 20.
Mm-hmm.
did computer science at Newcastle.
Yeah.
And then just kind of stayed on.
Yeah, nice.
Did work part-time in my final year for another systems integrator called Diamond. They're still around.
Yeah.
Did kind of, again, pretty broad systems integration work for them initially. And then when I graduated, I went and spent a couple of years as a developer for NextGen.net, mm-hmm. which actually one of your previous guests, I think it was Jeremy,
yeah.
Worked for them as well. So they're a Sydney company, but they've got a Newcastle office.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a couple of years, you know, on the keyboard, not really a much more focused sort of role, and B2B stuff, so not much customer action, just kind of implementing features and fixing bugs.
Yeah.
But that was really where I learned a lot of kind of software delivery practices, you know, mm-hmm. automated testing and version control and all those things that kind of foundational.
Yeah.
Is where I first learned all that. It was kind of that graduate role I took. And then I actually went back to Diamond for a few years after that. That business had changed quite a bit since when I left. They'd shifted into managed services. So there was a lot of sort of centralized monitoring and remediation. So I did that for a few more years, you know, kind of figuring out how we could detect problems or anticipate problems on people's systems proactively and try and fix them.
Yeah.
So very different to the old kind of break fix world that I'd come from. And then I think it was 2014, we started having meetups locally, like people started organizing these things that I'd never sort of heard of before. And I started going to, one of them was InfraCoders.
Yeah.
And
who actually started that?
That was, I think it was Matt Finch.
He started it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
Him and maybe someone else.
Yeah.
Maybe
Wayne?
Probably, yeah. We started going to that and met a lot of NIB people and started talking to them about what they were doing. And it sounded really interesting. So I kind of ended up going over there. And the first job I had at NIB was QA engineer, which is kind of like a test-focused developer.
Yeah.
Managed the team there for a period. And then the last couple of years, I've really kind of shifted gears a bit into the data and analytics space.
So, yeah.
As part of the migration to the cloud for NIB, you know, there's a data warehouse and analytics component to that. So I've been pretty busy helping them kind of rebuild their whole stack, move the data warehouse to the cloud, do all of the reporting and analytics off cloud services, which is quite a lot to cover there. So that's where I am now.
Yeah, nice. Ah, right, there's a lot there. Mate, I'm so, like, data role now, right? Obviously, there's a lot of companies starting to talk about data. Unfortunately, the word starting is still in there. there is a lot that, are, you know, only just starting to sort of dip their toe in the water, understand that, you know, where data can actually be powerful in their business, looking at, hey, what does our data actually look like? So I'm gonna cleanse that up. Mate, is there a reason or a key reason why you went down that data route or started digging it as an interest? Or
yeah, there's always an interest. I did, when I was at university, I did a machine learning course.
Yeah.
And I was really interested in that. It kind of had a big impact on me, actually, just the way I thought about what software could do. Mm-hmm. You know, up until that point, I'd sort of programmed computers my whole life. Very explicitly, you know, if this happens, do that.
Yeah.
Very logical. And that was the first time I'd seen an actual learning algorithm that you could say, here's how you can, you know, learn a trend or a pattern and have it go away. And I don't like to personify it too much, but, you know, it essentially arrives at the answer through that approach. So that was quite interesting. But when I studied that, it was kind of pre the big data hype. So, you know, it was in the middle of an AI winter. So no one was really talking about it. Not many companies were really doing what they now call AI. And it wasn't really until the cloud took off that people started getting really excited about it. So, and then probably add a few more years to that before Newcastle companies were seriously, you know, had the quantity of data and the use case to sort of look into it. And I think NIB is kind of an obvious place to do that in Newcastle, just because we have the scale.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's lots of situations where it's worth the time and effort spent doing it to get that result.
I agree. Mate, if somebody wants to set out to be into a role like yours, senior data architect, right, looking around, you know, obviously large sets of data, I'm starting to actually get some real insights into that. What's, mate, if you had to say, what's some key sort of paths to that? You mentioned you did some training in around machine learning, or was a course in uni. Is there any, I guess, early job titles that they should be seeking?
Yeah, it's changed a bit, I think, in the last few years, and data science is now kind of considered its own course. I did it as one subject, kind of buried in between software development courses, but I think data science now, they'll teach a lot more of the math, the statistics courses that you need to really make robust kind of analysis.
Yeah.
It's very easy to, particularly when you're dealing with predictive modeling, to misunderstand what the data is telling you. So I think it's important to not just learn to code and then cross over straight away. I think it's important to do a little bit of basic kind of statistics. But I think if you do any of the kind of online data science courses or through a university, then they'll probably tend to give you a healthy mix of that. And I think the other thing that's important is that you kind of pick up on the job is that domain knowledge. You really have to understand what the business is, and you know, behind it.
Yeah.
You can't just look straight at the data and not consider, you know, the real world behind it. Yeah. And, you know, it's one thing to make a prediction that's accurate. It's another thing to be able to make a change that can do something with that insight.
Yeah.
And often I think that's where my current role is important at NIB, is you have to know how it's going to connect back to that day-to-day process.
Yeah. Otherwise, no, I completely agree. Can't I think, yeah, no point data for data's sake, right? Like, how does this actually affect the business? Is there something we can do on the back of this? Are there some actionable insights that we can do to change business, help the business on the back of that data?
Yeah.
I think there's definitely, like, the further up you go in the tech world, the more importance there is about that greater understanding of business and tech. You know, what are we doing from a technology perspective? How does that actually affect the business?
Yeah.
Because as you said, there's plenty of really interesting data sets or predictive analysis that you can do within large data sets. But, you know, what's the point of this? You know, what are we doing it for?
Yeah, exactly. What's the impact going to be?
Yeah.
Often you can get good results on a, you know, kind of in the lab on a data set, but the change required to modify the production system or the process behind it might be really expensive.
Yeah.
So that could blow out the cost equation if you're not aware of that up front. I think a lot of material that's out there is starting to flag that, you know, make sure you know the total size of the project. Don't just go in on the data science piece thinking that once you solve that, everything will just happen.
Yeah, I completely agree. Mate, you made mention of machine learning just before. Obviously, AI is going to play a reasonably large part in the future of your type of role. What's your opinion on both of those technologies?
It's funny. It's technology that's been around a long time, but the impact of it has just changed a lot. So machine learning that we use today, the techniques haven't changed all that much in the last few decades, but the processing power and the size of the data sets have. So that's definitely, I think everyone would say that these days a lot more knowledge workers can have their roles automated than previously. So I think that's kind of a general trend, that where previously manual labor was getting automated through Industrial Revolution, now I think we'll see that a lot of decisioning can be maybe not completely automated, but augmented quite heavily by decision systems that use machine learning behind them. I think there's a lot of ethical questions that will I think have to be answered in the next few years in different industries about just because you can do something, you know, what's the impact of it, how a lot of these algorithms can have a lot of inherent bias in them that might make a different decision to what a human would, because they factor in less to the equation in a way.
Yeah.
So I think that a lot of people imagine these completely automated processes where no human touches it, whereas in reality I think it's kind of like it's a bit like machinery, you know, driving a tractor. There's always somebody that has some kind of supervising role,
yeah.
And then they kind of have this extended power that they use these systems for.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I was listening to a podcast the other day with Naval, and he was talking about, you know, the future of AI and taking more of those knowledge roles. As you said, I think machines are taking a lot of more of that process driven roles, but you know, knowledge driven roles will continue to be automated, and the differentiator will be creativity.
Yeah.
It's like optimized for creativity. It's that creativity part that's really will be next to impossible,
yeah.
I guess, for computers to understand. So it's that creative thinking that the human can bring to it. He was looking at it from a really, you know, positive perspective, that the crap work will get, you know, continue to be automated, or the, you know, the process driven stuff and the creativity will always be valuable there. It's like how can your creative brain use this technology to solve a problem or to serve a purpose? So I think you're on the money there.
Yeah, I think there's always a role for I don't think people will be automating the creative process in the near future. People can have fun with generative AI, you know, creating a song or an artwork with an automated process.
Yeah.
It's got a model behind it, but I don't know that's I don't think people are paying lots of money for that type of art.
No.
I think it's more a bit of fun.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Nice, mate. You've just returned to the US, right? In the US a couple of weeks ago. What were you over there for?
I was there for, there's a tech company over there called Snowflake. They're a cloud data warehouse.
Yeah.
They only had a product on the market for about 5 years, but they're going through pretty massive growth, and NIB was a pretty early adopter of that platform in Australia. So we were kind of their first big financial services customer. And we did a proof of concept with them earlier in the year for a feature of the product called data sharing, which basically means instead of sending files out to partners, you can just directly query people's data who you've allowed to. So we were doing a proof of concept on what that could do in our industry and how we could use it for transparency of cost information and so on. So yeah, I got invited to do a talk there on that proof of concept, just to kind of share what we built. Vendors love to have customers come and talk at their events. And so that's how I kind of got into that position.
Well, it's social proof, right, for them as a vendor, you know, to say, hey, here's a company that's actually using it, how they're using it, what sort of successes you're having.
Yeah, that's right. But it was a good conference. There were heaps of... There was other healthcare companies there, but lots of just their general customers from the US and other parts of the world. Got to meet a lot of people and go to a few events while I was there. So, yeah, it was a good trip.
Yeah, nice. Was that your first like major speaking event, I guess?
It's probably the first one of a conference of that profile, yeah.
Yeah, nice. How did you find that?
I'm not a huge fan of speaking. I don't mind doing it. It's not something I naturally love.
Yeah.
But I've done it enough that I'm comfortable doing it. So I don't think I was too worried about actually getting up in front of people. I really know too much about the venue logistics, or like how many people were going to be there. I think that was about 50 or 60. It was, you know, sort of a breakout room.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was fine. It was had some good questions afterwards. You know, I didn't make any terrible mistakes or anything. I got some good feedback, so yeah, nice. I was pretty happy.
The Q&A part's the most exciting, right? Like, or it's, you know, it's the most engaging, which is great.
Yeah, I think I prefer Q&A to prepared speaking
because
it's a little bit, you can't really overthink it because you don't know what's going to be asked.
Yeah. And it's easy to be confident because you're talking about your actual knowledge there, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From a speaking perspective, you mentioned you're okay with it, right?
Mm.
I wouldn't say that is the majority, especially for human beings, even less so for tech professionals. How did that come about? How did you build that confidence? Did you start out at some small meetups? Have you grown?
I've done a few talks at local meetups. I've done a couple of Sydney ones as well. And I think it's something that anyone can learn. Some people naturally do it well at the start. Other people have to learn it. But I think if you wanted to get into that, and you don't have any sort of, and no one's going out of their way to invite you, there's a lot of meetups that all you have to do is start going and they'll generally have fewer speakers available than speaking spots. So if you're someone in Newcastle who wants to do especially a tech talk, you should be able to find a time slot somewhere.
Mate, put your hand up and there'll be people to take you for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
No, I think Newcastle's really good, I guess, growing ground for that. There's definitely opportunity there for people to share a story and not be heckled out of the room. I think people give you time of day, and it's one of those things can only be learned through practice, right? As you said, there's very few people that get up there and nail it, day one.
Yeah, and also at those type of events, the people in the audience are usually a similar type of people as yourself, so it's a bit less pressure. It's probably harder to do a talk that's to a different audience than what you're comfortable with.
Yeah.
Like if you're talking to, you're expected to do some type of motivational talk, but you're a bit of an introvert, that's probably a lot harder. But to get up and talk about technical subject that you know, it should be hopefully less daunting.
Yeah, if it's in your sweet spot, it's about what you know.
Mm.
It's definitely harder to try to talk about something that gets out of your gym, right?
Yeah.
So speaking in the US, obviously for a company like yours, they're a massive US company, but I think it's been an opportunity that it'd be a no-brainer for you to take up, right? Being able to report NIB and the work that you guys are doing on the map in the US. Is it the way that you look at it? Easy thing to get signed off to go, yes, we're going to go across there and do that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, NIB has a brand in the Australian market. So, if you're representing a company, you obviously have to do that properly. And we have a corporate affairs team and some comms teams internally who definitely help with that. They'll tell you what to say or what not to say, how to not tarnish our reputation as a company.
Yeah.
They'll review slides and all those things. Different people from NIB have done talks, quite a few different. We've had people talk at AWS conferences, Salesforce, the OpenText, like some pretty big companies that have had us speak. More recently, Telium, which was a local event here in Sydney or in Sydney. So I think any time your company is like a well-known brand, you'll get more invitations to speak because that is obviously good for the vendor to get that. They like to have recognizable brands talking.
Yeah, kudos.
Yeah. But I think it's also good for NIB though, because a lot of people go to those conferences and see you kind of associated with these well-respected tech brands. So, it makes attracting talent easier because, if you go to AWS conference or Snowflake Summit and you see someone from NIB talking about cloud and big data and all that, you think, I didn't realize they were doing that. Kind of like what I went through with the meetup experience. You'd sort of assume financial services, there's probably not much exciting going on there, but it's kind of like almost a pitch to the job market in a way.
100%. Yeah. I think it's a big part of employer branding and talent attraction. There's only a few motivators, I guess, for tech professionals. Every individual has different motivators, whether it be lifestyle, where the actual location or the lifestyle that, a company can provide, financial stability, yada, yada, yada. Mm. But the actual tech stack and what they're working with is a big motivator for a lot of tech professionals. So being able to go to a conference, see a company, hey, their guys are using new technologies, they're doing really cool projects. I think that's it's a big part of, especially in tech.
Oh, it's huge because... that's really what you're going to be working on is then shaping what you can do in the future. So if you get stuck somewhere where they're getting left behind in terms of the tech stack, you know, that's actually got a cost to you almost by not keeping skilled up in those areas.
I couldn't agree more. It's easy to fall behind in the technology world, right? Get a company that's using old technology and not have an opportunity to upgrade that or to continue to move forward, and very, very quickly you can get left behind. Mm. And it's hard to catch up, right? It's hard to go for an interview at a new technology company and be, hey, this is the tech stack I'm using or that I'm familiar with. And there can be a real gap there.
Yeah, I think you also see that with, you know, 15 years ago, graduates were all trying to go and work at the biggest bank or, you know, government department or whoever they could get into as a graduate program just to get exposure to scale. But now you'll see people go and work for a startup because they're doing something innovative, and no longer the size of the company on the resume is as less important compared to what you were doing there.
Completely agree.
Yeah, so it's an interesting shift.
Yeah, man, I completely agree. What's the future for a role like yours? What's the future in and around? We talked about, you know, the newer technologies. Where do you see a role like yours going in the future?
I think there's... So I've been pretty busy with kind of a technology refresh, really, as we move to the cloud. There's a whole new stack to procure and get it all set up. You know, that's going to take a while to fully bed down. But I think my ongoing role is probably around how that fits in with the broader IT context. So my role, or the team that I'm in, is kind of like a group-wide team that's across all of the different IT systems, you know, in the NIB group. So more and more business systems are going to be basing some of their decisioning on these machine learning models or other kind of decisioning systems. So there's a lot of integration work to get involved in there, working on solutions where, you know, you can have data feeds that flow quite nicely where they need to go, and then taking those machine learning models and doing something with the output, getting it back into another system. There's quite a lot of work in that, and a lot of software vendors have a lot of a ways to go to catch up. I don't think we're a long way off being able to buy something off the shelf that can just plug into the back of a data science team's output.
Yeah. You know? Okay. I agree. If you wheel it all the way back, not all the way back, but back to the university days, you did your degree in Newcastle. Mm. How beneficial was that for you?
Yeah, it's, I always enjoy this segment of your podcast because there's a lot of different views. I think I have a pretty unbiased view on that because I've gone differently for different things that I've been interested in. So I think for me,
how did you break that down for me?
Yeah, so for example, you know, when I was younger, when I was a teenager or even primary school, I wanted to learn music. And, you know, obviously you can do very formal music training, and my mum took me to guitar lessons, and that was all about scales and chord progressions. But I didn't really take to that because I just wanted to play songs that I knew. You know, this was the 90s, so it was all about, you know, Pearl Jam and Metallica and Nirvana and all those bands. So I just wanted to pick up a guitar and play some music. And so I ended up learning quite a lot of music just based off grabbing the notation off the internet and just learning it, and that's what I wanted to do. So in that situation, I didn't really need this heavy theoretical background to do, you know, I wasn't going to play in an orchestra or from some, you know, experimental jazz band or something. I just wanted to play some music, and, you know, and from that I built and eventually did learn scales down the track and all that, but that was what worked for me. That was the style of learning that I liked, and it got me quicker to what I wanted to do than doing potentially years worth of foundational work before I ever got to do something I enjoyed. And when I decided to go to university for computer science, it was really just to improve my job prospects. I didn't really expect to learn too much from it. But I think in the case of computer science, there were a lot of subjects involved that I probably wouldn't have done myself if I wasn't kind of pushed into it. So some of the theoretical stuff, you know, the nature of algorithms and what they are, and some of the stuff that is a little bit more on the abstract. I'm the type of person, and there's people out there who would go and learn them as a hobby.
Yeah.
I'm probably not one of those people. So I think for me, that was beneficial to say, oh, you kind of have to do this and stick at it. And then eventually, you know, when you start learning how to code, all those concepts shape the way you think, even if it's only subtle. So I think for me, I got a lot out of computer science. But as I mentioned before, I didn't learn a lot of the practical stuff until I got my first job. So at university, you know, I learned to code, but I didn't write any test cases that were automated. I didn't really use version control systems. All that stuff kind of came in industry, which I think is pretty common.
Great.
Yeah, and I feel like, so I think the strength of university is that you can get a lot of those theoretical concepts. One of the weaknesses, I think, is that not all the people doing the teaching are really interested in teaching, because sometimes if you're an academic researcher, teaching is kind of part of your load. But I was listening to a podcast the other day, kind of said it's usually like a 40-40-20 kind of split. So 40% research, 40% teaching, and 20%, I guess, admin and everything else. And so they're not actually people who are always passionate about teaching. Yeah. And I think what that can mean is that not all the lecturers will go out of their way to make a concept easy to understand. It's kind of more like my job is to just present you the textbook, but you know, what the facts are. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's kind of your job to learn it. That's not true of all of them, but there's definitely a percentage of teachers at university where they're not actually really passionate about teaching, not passionate about imparting knowledge. They're passionate about their research
and subject matter.
And to sustain that job, they have to teach as part of it. So contrast with, you know, the online world where pretty much the courses that you do online are made by people who are trying to make it as easy. Their whole business model is you understanding the subject matter so that you'll keep subscribing. So they're doing everything they can to present a concept in a way that you'll understand. And I think sometimes in university, almost some academics actually like it to be a bit obscure, give you the most formal definition possible, you know, use as much mathematical notation as possible. And automatically half the room don't get it because that's not the way they learn. But if you present the same theory or idea differently, they would get it. So I think it's sad that a lot of people probably think, oh, that concept's beyond me, maybe they drop out of uni, but actually it just needed to be presented, you know, a bit more easily. So I think universities will have to compete against more against companies that are trying to make learning accessible rather than having this high esteem and trying to make things sort of difficult. That's my take.
Yeah, nice. All right. On that note then, if you were trying to design or give somebody the best upstart to someone to a career like yours, right, to become a data architect in as quicker or as efficient or effective method possible, what's the first 2 years look like? Is it a mix of formal education and non-formal? Sounds like there's definitely a mix of industry in there.
There is definitely industry, for sure. I don't think there's a shortcut. You kind of have to do a bit of all of those things, I think.
What sort of split are we talking?
So there's definitely, and it depends, data science even as a pursuit has a number of different kind of roles within it. You could probably find different team members in some data science teams now. So if you wanted to be in my role, which is very much on the kind of technology side. So understanding systems integration, you know, how to get data from one system to another, how to process it at scale, how to remove bottlenecks and all those things. I would definitely try and get a very well-rounded technology. You know, don't be afraid to get your hands on some infrastructure, some DevOps, do some coding. And I think the more generalist you are, the more broad your IT knowledge is, the better. I think if you go into it only ever having maybe been just a developer, you'll have to end up cross-skilling into all those areas anyway. You have to know infrastructure.
Yeah.
And I think if you're really wanting to focus on, well, let someone else take care of that side and really focus on just training models, machine learning, I'd do just a data science course that's focused on that. I think there's, I don't know of any off the top of my head, but you can do them online either through a university or just through just an education sort of websites, and they would probably take you through some foundations of statistics and kind of the just enough maths to understand what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then they'll go on and teach you how to code. So you learn how to, you probably use Python or R, that, and coding's a probably a different skill. I don't think you have to be an amazing coder to be a data scientist, because you're not building very big systems. You're generally scripting short pieces of logic. So, I mean, it helps to be a good coder, but these days people can kind of go straight into that role without having built software for industry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it sounds like definitely a mix of it, like an industry, like a really broad graduate type role where you get your hands on quite a few bits.
Yeah.
Learn some, like a breadth of knowledge, which is pretty much what you did when you're back up in Gunner, right? It was a really broad role to start with.
I think they call that T-shaped learning now, don't they?
Yeah. And then you overlay that. Yeah, that's right. And you overlay that with, you know, some more specific formal and informal trainings. That's definitely.
For me, I've always had a lot of hobbies outside work that are technical. You know, if during the periods of my career where I wasn't coding much, for example, I was, you know, managing a team of sysadmins, I would tend to do more coding as a hobby than when I was coding full time. I would just be off it. I'd go home. So I think, as long as you're kind of working on, I think find something you're interested in that you have complete autonomy over. So that's usually a hobby. Unless you have your own business, it's usually got to be a hobby. So for me, that's taken a few forms over the years. I've had pet projects that I've worked on where I'm the one deciding how it's built and what technologies it's built in. And then you get to avoid all that frustration of, I want to do this thing at work, but they don't let me because of some reason. I've done things from, I mean, even if it's building like a video game, you know, there's coding involved in that, and it's something that you find enjoyable and you get to kind of shape it yourself, get creative and do everything on your own terms. I think some of my best learning has come from those things.
Oh, I completely agree. I think tech professionals that have an interest in technology or build some projects outside, I would say to any graduate that's looking for work, build something.
Yeah.
Just build something.
Yeah.
I would take somebody that's got, you know, a heap of code, sitting in a GitHub account, or that they can show me something that they've built. I would take that over a piece of paper and a degree in a high market any day of the week. And it's you get a lot of learnings out of that, right? A lot of learnings out of teaching yourself, finding out a way, learning out a way if you don't know the way. You can always Google's your friend, right?
Yeah, that's right.
A lot of answers available online.
Yeah, well, Google's kind of like a essential part of tech jobs these days.
Isn't it a lot?
A lot of people won't admit it, but everyone does it.
Oh, sure. And so the information's readily available, right?
Yeah.
You do a little bit of search, you know how to search, and there you go.
Yeah.
You mentioned outside of sort of formal education, there's a couple of things you've done. Is there anywhere that you'd point people from an educational perspective?
from a, if it's particularly around data analytics, I've filled in some small gaps, I guess, over the years. From DataCamp is a good site.
Yeah.
So 4 or 5 years ago, it was probably one of the big ones, or one of the only ones that. But now there's probably a lot more. I found early on Kaggle was good. It's a website where people can post competitions for predictive modeling. So mm-hmm. a company or someone might post a data set, and you have to train a model on that data set and then score some sample data, and they basically have leaderboards. And that's a good website because A, you get to learn on some real data. You have some chance of winning a competition, although these days the professionals with a lot of experience tend to win them.
Yeah.
But you also get a lot of the people in that community are really good at sharing what they know. So you'll often see people who won a competition
yeah.
that maybe you had a try at winning
yeah.
Will then go and post the code that they wrote to get the winning entry, and you might learn something each time about a new technique for maybe the way you prepared the data or some of the parameters you use. So it's kind of good, nice sort of feedback loop. You get to be a part of a competition.
A little bit of gamification in there always helps, right? Like,
yeah,
you get that more and more in learning providers as well. Like, even as things as basic as badges, right? Badges for the different things you've done, but through sort of, you know, genuine competitions like that.
Yeah. And yeah, I think there's, for me, some of what I learn is a little bit on the fringe as well. So I'm really interested in general AI. So learning algorithms that can be used for any problem. So that there's a company I follow called Numenta that have a podcast, and they kind of post all their research online as well. They're very sort of open research company, but that may not be something you get to go and use at work because they're still developing and it doesn't really work in the industry yet. But it's kind of good to have whatever you think is kind of the next horizon, maybe in 5 or 10 years,
mm-hmm.
To at least be thinking about and try and follow it as it develops, rather than usually something happens and then everyone's scrambling to try and learn it or skill up and implement. But if you can kind of be
abreast of it
ahead of time, I like to do a bit of that sort of reading as well.
Yeah, nice. On the reading part, any books that you'd recommend for people?
Books. I've been pretty slack with books in the last few years, especially having young kids. It's hard to find time to read a book. I do listen to a lot of podcasts, obviously this one, but other ones as well. The one I just mentioned, it's called Numenta on Intelligence. That's really interesting. I do branch out a little bit and listen to things like history related stuff. Hardcore History is a good podcast if you ever want to just kind of step back and think about something a bit more a bit broader than technology and more kind of more just general interest stuff. I've got a mate who has a podcast called Publish Perish or Podcast. He's a it's about academic life, which I've never worked in academia, but I started listening to because it's pretty funny. There's a few researchers in this podcast, and they just talk about life in the academic world, and it's a nice...
I'm sure they bump into some interesting people.
Yeah, just the way you have to... what you have to do to have a career in that area, and it's just... it's good value to listen to. Books-wise... and again, on the education thing with AI, I think in the next few years, it will start to borrow a lot of concepts from biology, try to learn about how human brain works, to try and reverse engineer some of that and make the learning a bit more generalized.
Yeah.
So I kind of realized a few years ago, some of the good research that's happening is starting to include neuroscience in it. But I don't know anything about biology, so I was terrible at biology. I'm not very good with names. So as tempting as it was to go and study to do a science degree or something, I figured that would be a bad idea for me. So I kind of focus in on areas of neuroscience just enough to answer whatever question I have about a particular part of that research.
Yeah, nice.
And so I've read some books on neuroscience, just kind of for beginners, and I've even got a colouring in book that, like, that's great, because it was actually, I forget the name of it, I got it from Amazon, but some neuroscientists made this colouring in book, and it's got, you basically colour in parts of the brain, and they've made it so that they've used that technique that makes it easy to learn. So by picking certain colours consistently, using them in different contexts, it helps you learn. So, like, it's learning about the brain in a way that the brain's good at learning about. So it's kind of a bit clever.
Yeah, but nice.
I enjoy that. It's kind of relaxing. You can sit there colouring in. You don't have to actually read any text.
Learning without thinking you're learning.
Yeah.
On that note, mate, I think that's about the day. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers. Thanks again for listening to this episode. You can find all the show notes at newitechpeople.com.au. We're consistently updating the website with new show notes of new episodes, so you can also catch up with all our backlog of episodes, local tech professionals. Thanks again for listening.